Hi, welcome to week 8, can you believe it, of the Zogby Report, real and unscripted. I'm John Zogby, and I'm here with my son Jeremy. Say hello, son.
Hey, how you doing? Good to have you back, Dad.
Yep, I'm back in the very cold weather. I, of course, picked the wrong day to come back. But it is good to be home in many ways. But our focus is back down south again. And so it's all about South Carolina tomorrow, right? Big vote coming up.
Yeah, so let me ask you, as far as South Carolina goes, is this Biden? Well, I think we would both agree that this is Biden's do or die moment. And based on what's going on the ground in South Carolina, it looks to be that Biden has had a second wind.
A big second wind.
Yeah, his performance at the debate was probably the best he's had in a long time, if not the best overall. But how is he connecting with South Carolinians? How is he, what is he doing? And does it look like he's got this one wrapped up?
Well, to the degree that you can ever say wrapped up, I think you say wrapped up. If you take a look now at the last 5 polls that have come out since the debate, so that's a lot of polls, 1 or 2 daily, Biden's lead sequentially has gone from a +4, +8, +11, 13, 15, 16, and 20. And then there's one out just this morning with a 9-point lead. So all of those polls, it'd be hard to believe that they would be wrong. It does look, with the exception of this latest one with a 9-point lead that came out, like it could be a double-digit lead, which translated would mean a huge victory among the 60% or so expected voters from the African-American community. And so this is more than just a victory. If it in fact holds, puts Biden right back into the game for Super Tuesday.
Sure. And what do you think it was? I mean, what was it, his performance at the debate? I mean, obviously he's always done well with African Americans, and South Carolina historically is a state with a high percentage of African Americans. But what else is it?
Well, you know, I think essentially it's a couple of things. The first is, you know, we've resolved the battle for the left lane of the party. That's Bernie. And Bernie is the progressive, and Bernie will do well enough, probably well enough to meet the 15% threshold to get delegates, probably even better. So now it's the battle over the center lane. And what we've seen is Tom Steyer is doing well, and he's taking away younger African-American voters from Bernie, not older African-American voters from Biden. That's number one. But the other 3 centrist candidates, Bloomberg is not in the race, so that certainly helps. But he's fairly neutralized for the moment. So that leaves Buttigieg and Klobuchar, both kind of playing for that same college-educated, moderately liberal, higher-income voter, and zero support. And I do mean as close to zero support as possible among African-Americans. So in other words, the center has opened up to Biden. And then, as you pointed out, Biden had a very good debate performance this past week, looked statesmanlike, was forceful, and was not attacked. And I think that's very important because all the guns were focused on Bernie.
Yeah, and maybe to an extent Bloomberg as well.
Yes, a couple of firings, but they got him right in the heart, I think.
No, I know this is a little bit of old news, the debate that is, and it's been a few days now, but Bloomberg definitely improved his game, still probably fell a little bit short. By the way, I want to ask you and our listeners, did you catch that Freudian slip? I forgot what part it was in the debate, but he almost said he bought the party and then quickly retracted. And, you could look into that or you could just take it as a mistake. But did anyone catch that?
I caught it.
Yeah.
I'm raising my hand right now. Oh, I think a lot of folks caught it because basically that's what those debates are about, finding mistakes and catching them. That was a big one. And, what we know is that this time around, there were allotments for each candidate to bring their supporters in, and his people were paid to come in. And so you would hear cheers.
Yeah.
Now, he really has not campaigned in South Carolina, but you would hear cheers in the audience. Those are people who were flown in and bussed in. And so it was to make it sound like he had supporters there, when in reality, the supporters are very, very few.
So it looks like, you said that the progressive wing of the party, no doubt about it, belongs to Bernie. It's still the battle for the center lane. Biden looks to be on top. But we can't help forget the fact that the first 30 minutes of that debate were very painful to watch and listen. I mean, I could see a lot of people getting headaches because of the shouting. It was, I guess in a sense it was entertainment, but I couldn't help but think Trump and his administration were loving every second of that. So even though Biden brought a much better performance, Bloomberg had a better performance, there still is this backdrop of the party eating itself apart, and it was really obvious during the debate. What impact does that have in South Carolina? Does that only help Biden? And beyond South Carolina, does that still give us an indication that the party's not ready, no matter who it is, the party isn't ready to face Donald Trump?
Well, in many ways, it's not ready to face Donald Trump. It still has that key battle between the heart and soul, for the heart and soul of the party. That's not going to go away. No matter what, we're going to have at least two candidates who are finalists. Even if Bernie goes all the way and, runs as close to a sweep as possible, somebody is going to go to the convention with an awful lot of delegates and pick up the support of other centrist delegates and super delegates. And so it's going to be a battle royal. The one possible piece of good news is that Biden and Sanders, I wouldn't call them old friends, but they've been in the Senate together. They've known each other. They at least have shown the capacity to get along with each other. While they go after each other on policy, you don't see the vitriol or the real dislike that you see, for example, between Buttigieg and Klobuchar. I mean, they really hate each other. Nor Elizabeth Warren and Bloomberg, they really detest each other. So the possible good news here is that there could be possibly an embrace by the center and the left of the party. But it remains to be seen, even if it is Biden versus Sanders, whether Biden could deliver centrist moderate voters to a Sanders nomination, and we know this firsthand because we've worked with some of Sanders' people over the years, whether Sanders could even talk to even his own supporters and say, you've got to support Biden, he's the nominee. I'm not so sure that either of them could deliver.
So we know, we're comfortable to say we know Bernie's in the lead. It probably comfortable to say Biden's in second place. Let's just put two scenarios here. One scenario is Bernie gets the nomination. The other scenario is Biden gets the nomination. In scenario one, where Bernie gets the nomination, who is he likely to choose? Now, we could say who should he choose, but based on his personality and his characteristics, who is he likely to choose as his running mate?
Well, he's got to find someone who who's willing to run with him. That's important. You know, an Amy Klobuchar in many ways would be perfect. You know, the Midwest, those target states, a moderate. But I don't know that his supporters would endorse an Amy Klobuchar. And for that matter, she was the one person in the New Hampshire debate who said she would be very uncomfortable with a Democratic Socialist at the top of the ticket. You know, our son and brother, Jonathan, over at Zogby Analytics just did a poll with Trump-Pence versus Sanders-Warren. And Sanders-Warren actually wins by 4 or 5 points, which is interesting. Elizabeth Warren could be a very good nominee, although that is not the sort of thing that would warm the cockles of the heart of moderate voters, let alone Wall Street, or let alone, for that matter, the 40 or so new freshmen Congress people, including our own right up here, Anthony Brindisi, who are running, who won and won in districts that Donald Trump won in 2016. Those, they consider themselves possibly an endangered species, and having a left-wing ticket could really hurt. Bottom line is a very difficult choice for Bernie Sanders. Someone who will run with him and someone his supporters would endorse.
So let's look at 2016 with a great analogy, maybe the closest that we can come to in this scenario where Bernie gets the nomination. Who does he choose as his running mate? We recall in 2016 when Trump was on the campaign, he was the firebrand. He was the populist. And when he got the nomination, right, a lot of people were scratching his head. Who is he going to choose as his running mate? Well, the closest person that probably matched him in the sense of, I guess, populism, I maybe was Rand Paul, but we knew that wasn't going to be a choice. So here comes Pence, clearly an establishment guy. And Trump made the decision to pick Pence, despite that he was anti-establishment. Trump was anti-establishment, and look how that turned out. They seem to get along. They seem to respect each other. Now, how can I just find it hard to see Bernie, the firebrand, the populist, you know, on the left side, picking, you know, the equivalent of a Pence, although at the same time, he can't pick a Tulsi Gabbard. That would probably be political suicide. So I've started to hear the notion being thrown out there, and it could be ridiculous, but what about an Andrew Yang?
Yeah, you know, first of all, back to Pence. Pence represented very conservative wing of the Republican Party. So this was to a Trump not known for living by the Old or New Testament, chose someone very close to the Christian wing of the party. He also chose someone from Indiana, very popular in Indiana, which helped considerably, you know, in those Midwest states that he won. Plus, you know, say what you like about Mike Pence. He's from central casting, the white hair, the tan. Hey, get me somebody who looks like a vice president. Oh, you over there from Indiana, come here. Perfect in many ways. Andrew Yang is a very interesting, very smart character who has a real future in the United States. I think what Bernie has to do, though, is given his age in particular, he's got to pick somebody who's turnkey. Who there are no doubts about the fact this person could be president of the United States. I think also given the fact that he's an old white man, he's going to have to pick a woman. And so we're narrowing the field considerably here. Yeah. So that makes me think of, a progressive, someone who's younger, someone who is a woman.
Who is that?
And right now, as I'm not sure. And also someone who will run with Bernie. That's another thing. Someone who's willing to run with Bernie.
So let's do the flip side now. Biden. Biden gets the nomination. Mm-hmm. This is easier to answer. But right now, today, let's say Biden gets the nomination. Who is he likely to pick? Who is he going to pick?
Well, obviously, he's got to bend somehow in some way to the progressive wing of the party. There, in many ways, I think there's a power to choosing Amy Klobuchar. Her debate performances have been solid. She can take on Mike Pence. She also is a very good campaigner and has done well with very few resources. She's not a progressive, mm-hmm. however. Again, it's going to have to be a woman, and it's going to have to be a woman who is considerably younger. Biden, Kirsten Gillibrand, although she has really alienated some liberal women because of the strong stance, stronger than moderate stance, to be sure, in the Me Too movement. So she herself could be a lightning rod, but could be have considerable appeal to progressives, which is something that would help Biden in this instance. Another name that we hear an awful lot about is Stacey Abrams, who has been a state senator in Georgia, African-American woman in her 40s, and ran for governor in an election with some disputed results over vote count, did quite well. The significance there is that not simply, obviously, demographics, but you know, if Democrats are feeling good about the election this summer, you know, what they may want to do is go for some states that are burgeoning blue states, one of which would be Georgia. Growing African-American population, growing creative class and millennial population. And someone like Stacey Abrams, a known vote getter in Georgia, could certainly send a message you know, to states like North Carolina, I'm sorry, even Arizona, that are on the verge of turning blue. So she would actually be a good choice for either Biden or Sanders if she's willing to run.
Okay. What about Super Tuesday? We can't forget about Super Tuesday. What's your latest take on what could happen and what are the important things to look out for?
So over 1,400 delegates are selected, 14 states plus American Samoa, and it's a national primary, as diverse as you get. Sanders is leading in most of those states. Bloomberg is in second, but declining in a couple of states. And in other states, we don't have any reading since the Nevada debate, let alone the South Carolina debate. But the battle, I think, there is going to be between Bloomberg to some degree to see if the money spent was spent wisely. Biden, especially if Biden gets juiced up, and he probably will after South Carolina. And then that's Elizabeth Warren's last stand. And for Elizabeth Warren, she's in second place, say, in California. But she's also in second place in Massachusetts. That's her home state. And if she can't win Massachusetts, it really doesn't matter if she shows up in second place or wins somewhere else. But after Super Tuesday, I suspect Klobuchar, Steyer will be gone, and Buttigieg may very well have run out of juice by then as well.
So let's move on to the very important next segment, and that's about our latest poll. We have the second round of the Forbes Under 30 Voter Survey, powered by Zogby Strategies. I guess I'll just spout out some important points about what we found a couple days ago with this very important age cohort. First, I have to put as the backdrop that 2008 and 2012 are very key with this age cohort, the 18 to 29, because as some of you, our listeners, may recall, in 2008, Obama had 66% of support from this group. He almost repeated that in 2012 with 61%. We have found that Sanders is the only candidate that comes even closest to repeating those numbers. Sanders, among this important age cohort, is 57% of 18 to 29-year-olds. So really the headline is, it's all about Sanders when we're talking about the under 30 vote. I want to point out that came across a very interesting chart that shows the voter turnout over the years regarding the various age cohorts. And by the way, any of our listeners who are interested in seeing that, just send me an email and I'll share that with you. But when you look at the 18 to 29, by far the record turnout was 2008, obviously, because Obama excited them like no other candidate did before. If you recall in some of our earlier podcasts that I've been asking the question, who can sustain the excitement throughout this long haul, like Obama did with this group, or like Trump did with his base? I've been saying all along, Bernie is the only candidate that can sustain that level of excitement. So when we look at this chart and you see the skyrocketing or the record number of voter turnout among the 18 to 29, one has to think that 2020 is likely to see that kind of turnout, if not to surpass the 2008 turnout, because it is all about Bernie Sanders with this group. I just want to go over some other highlights here. Obviously the other key story here is really the battle of economic systems. That is capitalism or socialism. And some of you may be surprised to hear that it's about split down the line. So we asked this very important age cohort on their favorability towards socialism. 43% of the under 30 find socialism favorable. 39% find it unfavorable. On favorability towards capitalism, 50% are favorable, whereas 33% are unfavorable. Now, I'm going to press you, Dad, to explain what might seem like a contradiction here, because so many people associate the 18 to 29-year-olds with, favoring socialism. But we then wanted to take it to the next level and really press these voters, these likely voters. And we said, okay, we asked, if the United States had to go mainly one way regarding an economic system, mainly socialist, or should the U.S. go mainly capitalist? A plurality of 40% say mainly capitalist, and 34% say mainly socialist. So how do we understand that this group is indeed split when it comes to these two economic systems, yet if you were to pay attention to the media and maybe even social media, one would have the perception that these are a bunch of Cuban flag waving people?
Well, I think, first of all, to put things in perspective, very few pollsters would have even asked the question, capitalism or socialism, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, especially in the height of the Cold War. Socialism, though very different from Castro and Stalin and Mao Zedong and so on, still the terms were interchangeable as we were growing up. So the fact that they get to be entered together on a co-equal basis, let's say, in a poll of 18 to 29-year-olds, says something in itself. Yes, more are favorable towards capitalism, but the fact that one in three are not favorable, that better than one in three would choose socialism is better, gives you an indication that what this is a group that has suffered under the present system. The let's say the inequality, huge debt for much of their adult lives, the inability to find a job and yet to be saddled with an enormous amount of debt, kind of contrary to the American dream, or at least their parents' American dream. So they're jaded. Besides that, when they see lists, and millennials are really great with lists, where are the best countries to live? Where is the most sunshine? Where are people happiest? Blah, blah, blah. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, you know, countries like that that are democratic socialist, if I can use a term like that. Canada also getting high numbers. And so there isn't the fear of at least democratic socialism that you might you definitely find among voters over 65 who lived during the Cold War. That is where Donald Trump is going to create the wedge. We saw that in the 2019 State of the Union message, and again in the 2020 State of the Union message, that he's going to equate socialism to his base with Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, with the Castro brothers, with everything negative about communism. And he's going to portray, no matter who the nominee is, let alone Bernie, as leading a socialist party. That's to rev up his base. But Bernie, on the other hand, finding that his base is not so afraid of the term and continues to use it.
Well, it still begs the question, how did capitalism win when we asked the 18 to 29-year-old to choose a system? And what I would say is, yeah, it makes sense that this group find socialism appealing for the reason that you mentioned, where look at the happiest countries, Denmark, you know, Sweden, maybe Canada, but also being hit hard by the 08 financial crisis. But the fact that 40% of plurality would choose to go the route of mainly capitalist tells me that this group is very in touch with or favorable towards entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. We see that. We see a lot of new young entrepreneurs on these new platforms. Maybe they're YouTubers collecting monthly income. They're tech savvy. They're, you know, highly mobile. So they must realize, or a core base of them realize, that, look, if you want to live in a society where innovation is the goal, it's not going to be democratic socialism. It's going to be capitalism. But at the end of the day, we're about split down the middle, and it goes back to the point that I made when we brought up this conversation, that America is really at the crossroads. Will we become a democratic socialist country, or will we become a mainly capitalist society? It's probably going to come down to the 18 to 29-year-old vote.
Yeah, it is. And that's the vote of the now and the vote of the future. If they show up to vote, Democrats will do very, very well. And that, of course, has been Bernie's major argument. Centrist Democrats are going after him and saying, you're going to be a disaster. You're going to bury the party. Moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans won't vote for you. And Bernie says, first of all, I have an economic argument that can be very appealing to middle-class moderates. But more importantly, I'm counting, this is Bernie talking, I'm counting on these young people to show up to vote. Thus far, the turnout among 18 to 29-year-olds is not where it was in that 2008 benchmark that you mentioned. However, Sanders mm-hmm. is doing especially well among this group, and he's doing well, much better than expected, among Latinos, African-Americans. And I might add, moderates as well. He won among moderates in Nevada, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, so really it's going to come down to whether or not Bernie gets the shaft as many people felt that he got in 2016. If Bernie does not get the nomination, I'm comfortable in saying you probably won't see a repeat of 2008 and 2012 in terms of under 30 turnout. If he does, look for those numbers that Obama brought out to the polls. We're going to, because Dad, you have to get going. We're going to take a short break and then I'm going to come back and just do a quick wrap up. I want to do an update on the global front.
All right. Take care.
Welcome back, everybody. So I'm going to just take a few minutes to do an update on what is no doubt about it. The biggest story around the globe. I'm talking about the coronavirus. There's a lot of information that's coming out, and my sense is that a lot of people are feeling not only overwhelmed by the amount of information, but also the content. And it's generating a lot of fear. And there are a lot of contradicting reports and stories. So it would take really over an hour easily to go over all this, and I don't want to do that. So I want to do my best to just boil down what I see as essential and probably the future implications of this. First, let me start out by saying the most obvious fact. 60 million people in the Hubei province are on lockdown and have been on lockdown in their apartments for over a month, barely able to leave. If we look at today, the most recent numbers out of China show that the deaths are somewhere around 2,700. Now, to me, that raises a huge question. Are the actions, or is the action of a quarantine of 60 million people in line or equal to that small number of deaths? Just by way of comparison, let's remember that last year people died of the flu worldwide. Was there a quarantine? There wasn't anything like that. In fact, I would say that this quarantine that has taken place in the mainland of China is completely unprecedented. So it seems to me that there's some asymmetry there between the actions of the Communist Party coupled with the numbers. Remember, a month back when they called the quarantine, there had only been a few hundred deaths. So it really begs the question, is the data coming out of China accurate? I can't really see how it is, given that many millions of people are on lockdown. Now, I don't want to come off like I'm demonizing China. I think China is doing what probably most governments would do. Let's remember, they and the other governments that are battling this now are literally caught between a rock and a hard place. In fact, they're battling two viruses, one being the coronavirus and the fear of illness and death, and the other virus being the economic virus. I'm talking about the possible breakdown of supply chains. So it's easy to understand that the Communist Party would want to quell fears and wouldn't want to send out absolute panic throughout the world, by the way, which we're just starting to see. You saw the markets yesterday, the way that they reacted. The Dow had the biggest drop from its highs since the Great Depression. I'm not saying that the world is going to go into a Great Depression. I have no idea. But what I am concerned about is the possible or temporary breakdown of global supply chain. So I can't help but think, as somebody with a background in studying, reading, and teaching history, what are the implications of this? And if I were to say on this day, it to me right now, it looks as if globalization is being, or could be, called into question. And maybe the reaction could be in the long run that people, as comfortable as it was to have jobs outsourced to the other side of the world and have parts made in the other side of the world so that there was more affordability and convenience, all of this could start to be questioned. And I don't want that to be interpreted as me favoring tariffs and economic nationalism. This is just an honest observation and breakdown of what's going on and trying to understand its implications. As always, I'm going to continue tracking this to make more sense out of it. And I would love to hear some feedback from our listeners. And if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us. Jeremy@johnzogbystrategies.com. But for now, I'm going to call it a wrap, and we'll see you next week.